Good afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, today we're going to talk about cyber literacy. I welcome your questions and comments for Laura Gurek. She is Associate Professor at the University of Minnesota. She is a faculty fellow at the Law School at Minnesota, and she is the director of the school's Internet Studies Center. You may know her from her frequent appearances on Future Tense, a journal of the digital age. The feature produced by Minnesota Public Radio is heard here on AM 580 during the CBC program, As It Happens. Laura Gurek is the author of Persuasion and Privacy in Cyberspace and Cyber Literacy, Navigating the Internet with Awareness. Both books are published by the Yale University Press. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Laura Gurek, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's nice to talk with you. Well, what does it mean to be cyber literate?
Well, in the book, I talk about sort of basic meanings of literacy, which for most people usually means being able to read and write. And then I go on and talk about the idea that for some people, being technically literate is just kind of an upgrade to that. In other words, reading and writing and being able to use the computer. But the argument I'm trying to make is that being cyber literate, being really literate about what happens and how reading and writing and communication takes place on the Internet is really about being very aware of the social, cultural, and legal implications, everything from how electronic mail changes the way we communicate with each other to issues like privacy and copyright on the Internet.
Yeah. There's a New Yorker cartoon by Charles Barsotti that features a man standing next to his barbecue grill, and his telephone is walking toward him. It has feet. And it's ringing, the telephone is ringing, and this man is clearly perturbed. He says, "What the hell sort of convenient new feature is this?" And to quote from your book, you say, "Communication technologies shape our social and cultural spaces." You're on the same wavelength here, I think, with Charles Barsotti. How is the Internet shaping these spaces that we inhabit, social and cultural?
Well, just take the issue of privacy, for example. Privacy has always been a concern for U.S. citizens in particular. U.S. citizens are concerned about their rights to privacy, and online we see really high-end uses of technology to manipulate personal data, to buy and sell demographic information, shopping information, and so on. And that's a really different way of living than before the Internet. I mean, people were still doing data matching and stuff before the Internet, but now it's really easy to go online and find out things, and it's really easy for companies to share information. So your sense of what's private information about you and your family and your spending habits has changed somewhat dramatically.
How much is known about us by those folks out there who are?
Well, lots and lots. You know, there's very little law that regulates what can be done in the U.S. with personal data. And so what you get are technologies that are doing so many things behind the scenes, and even e-commerce sites that tell you they won't do certain kinds of data matching, they are not really regulated by the law, so they may still be doing lots of kinds of things. You know, there's the interface to what goes on the Internet, and then there's what's actually happening behind that screen.
So those online privacy statements, that's strictly the honor system.
Yeah, except for, you know, very specific kinds of law in the U.S., like laws that govern issues about what's on your credit report, or laws that don't allow people to tell what movies you rented at Blockbuster, very specific laws like that. There's nothing in general. It really is the honor system. In Europe, the Europeans have passed something called the European Data Directive, which actually makes it law. You have to ask people to use their information. That's called the opt-in model. In the U.S., it's all self-regulated. So, and actually, if you look at some of those privacy statements and you read them with a cyber-literate kind of eye, you read them with a critical eye, you will notice that they say a lot of things to make you feel good, but they don't actually make a lot of promises about what they will or won't do.
Mm. Tell us more about the European Data Directive.
Well, the European Union passed the data directive, I think, about 3 years ago, it sort of canonizes some of what has already been law in countries like Sweden or Germany, where citizens have the right to know how you're using their personal data. They have the right to control what's being shared, and they have the right to make corrections if there's mistakes. And this is basically an opt-in model. So if a company wanted to use your information, resell it, for example, to another company to use for marketing of some kind, they'd actually have to ask your permission. In the U.S., of course, we have the opt-out model. It's on your shoulders to opt out, and we all know that those opt-out schemes don't last very long or work very well.
I wonder how many of us read online privacy statements.
Well, that's an interesting question. I was actually thinking of doing a little study about that here because one of my areas in my background is that I've been a technical writer, and that's one of the things I teach here at the University of Minnesota. And technical writing, we know that people read information really quickly, and the longer the information, the less likely they're going to read it. And then on the screen, we know that people read information even more quickly with even less patience. And if you look at those privacy statements, they're longer than most legal documents you might get, you know, with an insurance policy or something. So I've actually been interested in doing a study to see, you know, like if you went into a privacy statement on an e-commerce site and way in the middle you embedded a sentence like, we have the right to take your firstborn child, you know, and then you did a study later to find out how many people actually noticed that statement. Mm-hmm. I'd be surprised if many people realized what they had signed away.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about the internet that we all love is its speed. And if this privacy statement is slowing us down, who wants to read that?
Well, that's right. And, you know, I think even though some of them seem to be written in a rather user-friendly way, most of them are so long and so obscure that most people aren't going to bother. They're just going to read and move on. I mean, and that's another sort of interesting social issue, isn't it, is how we read, how we write, what we call writing has really changed.
How is it changed by the internet?
Well, you know, most information online is what people in computer science or usability fields would call chunked. It's in small chunks. It's linked. Everything is linked to everything else. The traditional essay you might teach a student to write in, let's say, a freshman writing class, you're not going to really find that kind of writing very much in an online world. You're going to find short chops of information, ideas that are linked, people read in non-linear fashion, and now you start to see people, particularly young people, who are being raised with this kind of linguistic forum, and next thing you know, they're starting to write their school assignments in that same way, almost like if you notice a lot of the conventions from email, like the smiley face, they're actually built into Microsoft Word now. So when you type the colon, hyphen, write parentheses in Microsoft Word, and then you press the next key, whatever that might be, it turns it into a high-end ASCII smiley face. So we're seeing these conventions that started off in this kind of telegraphic space that's a mix of oral and written communication styles, now moving back in and really challenging a lot of the ways that we teach writing, a lot of the ways that we understand what counts as reading and writing.
Mm. We're all familiar with the term sound bites, but I was not familiar with the word sight bites, which you use in the book Cyber Literacy.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, part of what we're seeing online, of course, is a communication form that values visual information. And we're in a culture that has traditionally valued written communication. That's considered sort of the pinnacle of being literate, is if you can write a certain kind of way. And yet what we see in really successful sites online is that it's the visual part of the literacy. In fact, if you ask people, take sites like medical information, and you ask people to look at 10 different sites and you ask them to tell you which ones they found to be the most credible, it's not always the features of the language that they first point out. It's often the interface. Well, it looked real. It looked professional, you know. That's a very different. That's not what we're used to thinking about. Maybe in the realm of television, but definitely not in the realm of what used to be considered just written information.
Yeah. So, cyber literacy is a heightened literacy. And, you know, I think our ideas of literacy are changing as well. You offer some discussion about this in the book. It's not enough to be able to know how to read and write these days. You also have to be media literate.
That's right. And, you know, what does it mean to think about traditional media in this context? I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, the new media. Well, you know, what's so new about new media anymore? A lot of this isn't new. I mean, the Internet's 30 years old, and the use of the Internet with a browser dates to about 1993. So it's not so new anymore. It's really pretty mainstream if you think about it. And you watch how the effects of Internet-style reading and writing and communicating has filtered out everything from the ways you watch your TV now has changed to really the way people communicate face-to-face has changed.
Offer us some examples of that.
The face-to-face part?
Yeah.
Well, some people, and, you know, I can't really make a causal argument, but, I mean, some people have noticed that during the rise of this culture of speed, which, you know, I talk about in the book, speed as being one of the four defining features of online space, in this culture of speed, we suddenly get sort of a speedier, less patient culture as a whole. And, again, you know, it'd be a different thing for me to try to make that as a causal argument, but you see people getting more impatient in lines, and we see road rage, and, you know, it's all tied to a culture where things are of a much speedier nature. And I know just anecdotally that a lot of people who use the Internet a lot, I get very impatient with long-winded anything, meetings, discussions. And so the style of communicating on the Internet is very short. You know, brevity is what counts. And, you know, that's a good thing in some way, but in another way, in a democratic culture, it's important to know how to have long, sometimes complicated discussions to get to the bottom of things.
Mm. Well, who hasn't become impatient when a web page is slow to come up on the screen?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, as the web pages get more complicated, and then you need to buy faster computers, and you suddenly it's almost becoming imperative to have a DSL or cable modem or some kind of high-speed line and coming into your house. So it's actually sort of being fed to us in that way. I think anybody with a slow modem now probably has a terrible time doing any kind of work online.
Well, here at WILL, we have a very fast service, but sometimes the traffic on the web is heavy, and one of the things I really like to do is read newspapers online.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't get the New York Times within a certain number of seconds, I'm on to the Washington Post or the Christian Science Monitor or something else.
Right, and, you know, that's one thing that we notice over and over is, you know, people are only, I don't know what the latest study figures are, but, you know, there's a certain amount of time after which if people can't get the page to load or something happens, they just dump out and go somewhere else. So it really does encourage a culture of speed.
Yeah. You know, the Wall Street Journal yesterday unveiled a new look.
I read.
And one of the things was better navigational tools on the front page.
Kind of interesting because a lot of these concepts have been around if you have done technical writing or things like computer interface design for a long time. You know, technical writing's always been about good navigation. I mean, you know, if you're looking at a user manual for a product, be that your home tractor or, you know, your computer software, you don't want to read it like a novel. You want to be able to navigate quickly to the part that explains what you want to do, that people call this task-oriented reading and writing. It's suddenly we're in a very task-oriented world, and people are not really interested anymore in these sort of very linear, very narrative traditions. So here's the newspaper responding to the Internet, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm. And you tell readers your book is, in a way, designed in a hypertextual fashion.
Well, it's tried to be. It's written in something of a chunked kind of fashion. You can read any chapter in any particular order you like. That's within limits. It still is kind of looks like a scholarly book with an introduction and conclusion. So I can't lay claim to completely having written the book in the manner that I would have liked. And, you know, some of that is the reality of publishing, particularly academic publishing. It's a whole lot to keep a website going that's as linked and nonlinear as you'd like. But there is a companion website, and We originally had all the chapters of the book available on the companion website in PDF format, and we've taken those down to revise them so they match better the content of the book, but we'll be putting chunks of it back up again soon. Mm.
Is the Internet having an impact on the narrative form in non-technical fiction kinds of storytelling?
Well, I don't know. I don't read too much of that sort of thing, but I would think that it would overall, just as, you know, chapters would get shorter, and people expect to be able to move around in a certain way on the web, I think that people are going to expect to be able to do that in a lot of other sources. I think there will always be a place for a good story, you know, with a starting and stopping point, and so I don't think we have to worry that it's the total death of literature, although there are a lot of people who've been experimenting for at least 20 years now with hypertext fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are in the middle of a story, and you can choose the link in terms of what direction the story goes.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of a couple of films that come to mind now that are not told in a linear fashion, Memento and Pulp Fiction.
Uh-huh. Yep, I have to confess to not having seen either, but I have certainly heard that.
Well, it's interesting to I know that there isn't really an answer to this type of question, but it's interesting to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk more about speed and techno rage. Have attempts to bring etiquette to the netiquette, have they been successful? Are we, you know, now that the technology has been with us for a while, are we finding a sense of what it is to be polite in this space?
Well, it seems that the most successful places to invoke or ascribe to some kind of an etiquette in that way are the sites that really have a lot of sort of self-regulating, where people, there's a sense of community, and if someone on the message board or list or a discussion group is acting out of outside the norms of what that group considers to be acceptable or polite, that person is kind of shunned, if you will. So, I mean, that goes, I think you can trace that back to the very earliest, what were then called, still are, news groups on the Internet, where they would publish often a frequently asked questions list, which would sometimes say, listen, this is the purpose of this group, and this is how we like things to go, and if you can't do this, then maybe you should find another list. So that's a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing in that it can leave out voices that don't necessarily agree. But there are I think a lot of sites just have kind of maybe not even spelled out, but just a certain standards of how they'd like people to communicate. And if you see the sites that are really kind of bottom up, where people are doing the self-regulation, it seems to work pretty well.
Mm.
I mean, if somebody keeps being a real pain on a particular posting board or list, and everybody ignores them, eventually they'll probably just go away.
Does protected speech on the Internet differ from protected speech in other settings?
I don't think anybody would say that it does. I think the standard line, you know, is that speech is protected until such speech invites violence, and that was why it was agreed that the site that promoted violence against physicians who were performing legal abortions, that site was shut down because that site seemed to cross the line. But the idea of censorship online gets kind of complicated because of the speed and reach of the Internet. So sites that inspire hate, for example, or sites that some would consider to be overly pornographic, are a little bit easier reached by groups of people. It's easier to bring all kinds of communities together online, both good and bad. And so the stakes seem to have gone up a little, which is why we have lots of discussions all the time about filters that can be installed as a way of letting people kind of control for themselves or their families what they see online. Of course, these filters have problems. There's some First Amendment problems, and they also just have problems in that they might screen, while they're screening out certain words, they might also screen out uses of those words for educational purposes, let's say. So that's still a real challenge online. And, you know, whenever we see, like, the Communications Decency Act, that was just went too far in terms of trying to describe what should be available on the Internet.
Yeah, it might be a useful tool in some instances, but if you're a cyber-literate adult, it seems like a filter would be unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. One of my classes here, an undergraduate class we've got called Rhetoric, Technology, and the Internet, students were looking around at sites that that are both for and against certain kinds of online censorship, and they found a site that was about, it was families who were against censorship, and they were basically saying, you know, that we should be monitoring and regulating what our kids see on the Internet. We shouldn't be relying just on tools to do it.
Very interesting. Our guest this afternoon, Laura Gurek. We're talking about cyber literacy. She's associate professor at the University of Minnesota. She's a faculty fellow at the law school there. She is also director of the school's Internet Studies Center. She's the author of Cyber Literacy, Navigating the Internet with Awareness, the book published by the Yale University Press. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls. Join the discussion with your questions and comments. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In the classroom, how do you deal with the issue of plagiarism and the web?
Well, that's another interesting issue, too, that's so heightened by a technology that basically was built by what we might call plagiaristic norms, in a sense. The Internet, like a lot of software, was built based on the idea that it's good to share things, and it's good to give away things, and it's good to take things and acknowledge them, but use them. So a lot of the code that we see online is code that early programmers built and shared with each other. And in fact, even today, if you see a web page that you really like and you think, I'd like my web page to look something like that, you can just, usually on most browsers, you can say view source, and still most of the time you'll get to see the source code. So when you raise young people in an environment with a dominant technology like this that's built on shared information and makes it really easy to cut and paste things from one site to the next, it gets pretty complicated to start talking about plagiarism. What I try to do here is have a whole day devoted to that discussion, to go online and look for a lot of these sites that offer free downloadable papers, which my students quickly discover are really bad papers, sort of like C papers, and none of them would ever want to turn one of those in anyway, and to talk about the cultural notions of plagiarism, how those are different from culture to culture, and to just talk about the ethics and kind of moral sense that you get from doing your own work and coming up with ideas that if they're not yours, they're carefully footnoted. And so we really spend a lot of time talking about it and talking about the ease with which people can cut and paste. Your listeners may know there's some software out there that some professors use where you can take student papers and run it through this tool, and it will kind of look on the web and look around for you and give you a score as to how much it thinks the paper might have been plagiarized. Whether that's a good approach or not is questionable. There's students who will always be able to outsmart those tools by writing better tools themselves. So one of the things that I really believe in is that you should just have a good discussion about this and, of course, do the things you've always done to avoid plagiarism. Create assignments that require several drafts, require original writing, and so on, but also to really have a good talk about it, go online, teach students about how to evaluate the sites they find in terms of their credibility as sources and how to properly cite. I think if you look at a lot of textbooks in writing and in other fields, they just really don't give students a lot of information about how to find information on the Internet for school projects and then how to cite those sources the way you would cite a paper or a newspaper article. You know, sometimes students don't know what to do and they'll just turn in a whole list of URLs at the back of their paper. Well, most of the style guides now have rules for how to do that. So it seems like, in a way, your students are always going to be ahead of you on this topic. So why not have a discussion and let them tell you what they think, too, and try to come to an understanding that way.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line four, the toll-free line in Danville. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question, I'd like to know if the guest is familiar with special needs software, in particular voice synthesization.
Yeah. I'm not really familiar, but I do know that the Americans with Disabilities Act has required a lot of companies to think about how to create web pages that are easily read by voice recognition software.
I was talking more for home use. That's okay. What's holding me up from buying another computer, because the software is so expensive. But I've noticed that they've come up. Consumers Union reviewed three recently, and I think the most expensive one was only $50 versus what I'd been used to was running from $800 to $1,200. And I was just wondering if you knew anything about them.
What kind of software specifically do you mean?
Well, see, I'm texting Pixel Challenge, so I need something that will read the screen to me, plus that I could, like, if I'm doing using Word, I can integrate commands to work with, between the two softwares.
Mm-hmm. So like screen reader software that
yes.
will read the text back to you?
Yeah, but I don't want the real cheap stuff
if
it's, choppy. Because
mm-hmm.
that just, you won't fool with it very long.
I have heard from other people who use this type of software that some of it is pretty decent and some of it is really pretty bad. And that, but I don't have anything to offer you specifically about any software products that I know are out there. I do know, however, that companies, people who make websites, are aware that there are people using screen reader software, and they're trying to design their sites so that the sites are easier to read for screen reader software. Because some of the early websites where people never thought about this, I guess the screen reader software was just had a terrible time with certain kinds of web pages.
Yes, they're exceptionally graphic.
Right. So, the thing to do, too, is if any of these sites are commercial sites especially and you find that your screen reader software has trouble dealing with the site, you might want to let the company know that you're out there and that they need to pay more attention to that.
Well, see, but the reason I called was, once you buy it and hook it up, it's yours, And I was hoping maybe, you knew something about the newer ones.
I'm sorry, I don't. I know generally about these products, but I don't know anything in specific. There might be somebody at the university there who who does work with, it would be a field called human-computer interaction, mm-hmm. or someone in the computer science group, and they might actually know for you about what some of the latest products are. I'm sorry, I can't help you.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That's probably a topic that we should investigate here on this program. We
mm-hmm.
could have some people in, because I know that this is an issue that is very important in folks with macular degeneration, for example,
mm-hmm.
Who want to use the computer. There have been some special tools developed for them and also the voice recognition systems that are out there and are being developed. It's a very interesting field. So
it seems to me maybe an Association for the Blind and Visually Handicapped or something, too. They might be doing reviews that are maybe even more specific than the Consumers Union one that the caller mentioned, and they might have a ready answer for her on that, too.
Okay. In the meantime, I'll put that on my list of potential topics down the line here regarding technology. Our guest this afternoon, Laura Gurek, we're talking with her about her book, Cyber Literacy, Navigating the Internet with Awareness. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. My name is Celeste Quinn. The telephone numbers, if you'd like to join us with questions, comments, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, we were talking about plagiarism, and how you handle that as a professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm wondering, and at the end of your comments, you mentioned that you learn a great deal from your students. And I'm wondering Is there something recently that there's some insight that they've given you recently that you've taken some time to think about?
Well, the one issue I mentioned was rather insightful for me, and that was just, you know, everybody walks around thinking that students would naturally, you know, want to take a paper off of one of these, you know, paper sites where students can download papers. But when you talk to the students, they were just disgusted by it, and they were disgusted by the quality of the papers on the site. And actually, that was, you know, that changes your perception, I think. The other thing I learn all the time from my own students is this technology is changing and evolving, and the students are students you get every year are younger and younger than the generation-wise. And so every year that you've got students who grew up a little bit more and a little bit more mm-hmm. with personal computing, and the social uses that they have for the computer are changing, and that's really insightful to me. I think the things that we, you know, helps us figure out sort of what to teach in a way that's relevant for them. You know, when I first started looking at the Internet in the early 1990s, things like real-time chat, like the AOL Instant Messenger and IRC chat and all those things were not really very popular, and now that seems to be really, really pretty standard. And that's a really interesting use of communication.
Mm. We talked a little bit earlier about speed and how the speed of the Internet is shaping our interactions with one another face-to-face. As a teacher in the classroom, has that affected you?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's required me to create lessons and instructions that are also shorter in a certain way, that hold attention spans only for a certain period of time. I think it challenges all of us to integrate more visual and other forms of technical sort of communication where we might not otherwise do that. I mean, writing today is about formatting. I mean, people format as they write. It used to be that you would type up your book, and then you would take it to a compositor, and they would decide on the fonts with you, and they would, you know, typeset it and figure out what would be italic and what would be bold. And all of those things, of course, affect the final outcome of the product, the information product, if you will. But when students write anything today, whether it's in a writing class or a science class or any other kind of class, they're formatting as they write. So it's really kind of hard to teach writing in any environment if you aren't also teaching them about visual literacy. You know, just the use of fonts alone. We think about, for someone in my age group, just to think about the shift that took place when people could suddenly format all their own text.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Oh, we've got another caller coming in here to talk with us in Washington, Illinois, on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about speed, and it seems like every time speed goes up, the people who make the software eat that amount of speed and more, so the website downloading just keeps getting slower and slower. And have you ever heard of any technical solutions to this?
Well, you know, I think there is a move toward broadband, and I don't think it's really a secret as to why. I mean, if the websites that come out today required you to have just a little more speed than you have now, at some point you're going to give up and go buy another computer, or you're going to call up your cable modem or your DSL or whatever and get a higher speed connection. So technically, you can still, the things I know about, and there might be other callers who are more knowledgeable about this than I am, but you can still look at certain pages with a low graphics. A lot of pages will still let you pick the low graphics version, so it'll take less time mm-hmm. to download. But in the end, I don't think it's a battle anybody is particularly going to win, because there's a move toward integrating. You know, I think people want what's on the computer to sort of be like what's on TV now, like real time and very quick. And the companies that make the computers want you to keep buying bigger and better ones. So, but the one thing I do know about is that there are sites that do let you take a sort of a lower download version of the site. Maybe some other callers know a few more things.
How do you get a hold of a list of such sites?
I don't know. I really don't know if there is a list. I don't know if it's just a matter of going to the sites you like and seeing if they have a button that says, you know, click here for the non-graphic version. But I don't actually know if there is any sort of list like that.
And if someone came up with a technical solution that let your computer load really fast, but it butchered the site, would there be any copyright issues in presenting someone's site in a very butchered, fast way?
That's a good question. I think that it would certainly be possible that the whoever holds the copyright to the site might not like that. There have been cases where if you had a website and you did what's called deep linking, in other words, if I link from my site into your site at like the third layer rather than the main home page, some of those sites were getting mad and saying, look, you know, we don't want people deep linking. We only want people linking to the very, very front end, and they were making that argument in terms of copyright infringement. So, you know, it certainly is possible that some companies would say you can't load the site in chunks or in bits and pieces. You've got to load it the way we want it. You know, for every problem like that, though, someone will just come up with another kind of technical solution. So if someone invents or has invented the software that lets you get the kind of stripped-down version and the company doesn't really want you to get the stripped-down version, they'll just do something to their site so that it won't play nice with the software you're using. So it kind of becomes a domino theory in a way. But, you know, there might be some software out there already. I'm thinking about the previous caller's question about screen readers. There might be software now that some of the screen reading software uses to make the site a little easier for that screen reading software. That might do the trick. As I say, I don't really know a specific.
What happened in the deep linking cases? Did the copyright owners win, or did the people deep linking win?
I don't remember where that's at right now. The last thing I knew was that the argument seemed to be that copyright wasn't the right way to go about prosecuting that kind of problem, that it really was not a copyright infringement, that there might be some other way to go about it, but that copyright wasn't the way to get at it. So I don't know what the status is of the latest on those deep linking cases. There's a couple of really good websites that have compiled all the deep linking stuff that's gone on, the different cases and different points of view. I think if you just go to a search engine and type in deep linking, you'd find those really fast.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call
this afternoon. You know, in the book, we've been talking a little bit about copyright here. In the book, you note that copyright law should be opening up, and instead it's becoming more restrictive. Why is copyright law becoming more restrictive on the Internet?
Well, here's a technology that sort of defeats a lot of what copyright has tried to do, which is, if you look at the history of copyright, it started off as a very, very short term, and now it's been extended with the passage of the Copyright Term Extension Act, also called the Sonny Bono Copyright Act, to the life of the author plus 70 years. So after you die, 70 years later, your work is still held up from entering the public domain. So you have a technology here that suddenly allows all kinds of like regular people to cross those kind of boundaries that publishers and music folks, music industry people have held up, and now you can sort of share information. Like I said, the whole technology was built on the idea of file sharing. Professor Lawrence Lessig who's at Stanford University Law School has a new book out called The Future of Ideas, where he talks about this thing that's happened. On the one hand, we've got a technology that could really allow for a lot more common information and sharing of information. On the other hand, and here's the reason why, you get the most people who hold copyrights are not individual authors. They are large corporations that own the rights to books and music and so on, and they certainly don't want to see copyright defeated. If anything, they want to see it more restrictive. So at the same time that you have a technology that opens up all new possibilities for how to think about intellectual property, we have a group of industries that are just hanging on for dear life and actually lobbying so hard that they're able to get things like copyright term extension passed. So you've got, on the one hand, the technology that allows all kinds of new ways to think about intellectual property and ownership, and on the other hand, a set of industries that don't want to let go.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about search engines. I saw a headline someplace saying that it looked like Google might be in trouble because people were manipulating their sites to get themselves put on on the first page that comes up when you use search engines. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, well, you know, all search engines are not created equally, and I think that's something most people don't know. And in particular, I think it's really important when we go back to the previous topic about teaching students, how to use the Internet as a research tool, or just regular people, right? I think one of the biggest uses of the Internet now for research is regular people looking up medical information, because that used to be very tightly controlled information. Now you go to the doctor, they give you some drug, you come home, you type it in the search engine and you read 500 pages worth of information. So, but that not all search engines are created equally, and they all use different algorithms or logical ways of searching to find information. So what you find with one search engine isn't the same as the other. And in the Google case, it's my understanding that Google uses a kind of sophisticated algorithm that looks not only at the string you've typed in, but also at sites. The number of hits that certain sites have received, that's my understanding of how it works, and that some people, the name of the game in the Internet is to get your page to show up, and so that some people were trying to work their site so that it would be the first hit. We've got this Internet Study Center here, and we're basically just a web page with a lot of links, and every so often my team and I will just go into all the major search engines and search on our site and see where we show up, and for a while we'll show up first and then all of a sudden we won't, so we go back in and change the tags and the headers and stuff to make sure that we show up. But I think for especially sort of your beginning Internet user that gets a free service somewhere for a while and maybe it even comes with its own search engine, they don't realize that all searches are not created equally.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that was interesting about having to work on your site to keep it up there. Another question I had, and then I guess I'll hang up, is I was just curious if some of these forums I get on occasionally have an option to call another forum participant a friend, quote unquote, and I haven't explored what that could possibly mean. But it made me curious as to whether you have any data as to whether people actually form can or do form relationships through this kind of forum activity. I'm kind of curious about that. It would seem to me it would be very fleeting. But I don't know.
You mean like online dating and stuff?
Well, you get on a forum to discuss the Middle East, say, or and then you find people who are pretty much arguing in the same line you are, and I can imagine you might want to contact them, to maybe some sort of exchange of information, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a and not to mention it also ganging up on people with the opposite point of view. You know, call up this guy and say. Or rather email this guy and tell him, it'd be a good idea if you get in on this forum because we've got this blowhard espousing such and such stupidity, if you get my drift.
Well, what you're talking about is a lot of what people have looked at in terms of online community, right? It's really the Internet from its very beginning. If you look at some of the earliest papers on what was then the DARPANET, ARPANET, people talked about the power of this kind of network to bring together communities, people of common interest who share ideas and get to know each other. And sometimes, in my first book, Persuasion and Privacy, I've got a little cartoon from one of the earliest inventors of the Internet that I took out of his paper to show that that even then they were thinking about people might meet online and then they might, you know, actually meet somewhere. So that's sort of the power of community, right, is people from across the globe who have common ideas, common interests, hobbies, would get together, and you really can't do that in any other way than an asynchronous network. But at the same time, the sort of danger that's always true in any community, and maybe it's particularly true in online community, I write about this more in my first book, is when you have someone who has a dissenting idea in an online community, you often don't have to struggle with that dissenting idea. That person maybe will just leave because they feel like they've been bullied. They'll just say, well, this isn't worth it. I'm not going to hang out on this site anymore. Whereas in your town, your physical community where you live, if people disagree, I mean, the idea of democracy is you're supposed to be able to get together and kind of work out those differences. But online, if you don't agree with somebody or they feel like they're the outside voice, they often just leave and you never see them again on the site.
With that, we've got to stop. We're out of time. I hope that maybe in the future we'll talk again.
Sure, be happy to.
Very good. Laura Gurek has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our thanks to her for joining us this afternoon. Her latest book, Cyber Literacy, Navigating the Internet with Awareness. The book is published by Yale University Press.